You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I am Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas. And you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for May 1st, episode 3682, Good Morning Horse World.
Your favorite day of the week.
You never stop learning. You never stop understanding. It's more in depth than just riding a horse. Knowing that for the rest of my life, I could work on this and I'll never stop learning.
Welcome back, Mary.
Yay. Thanks for having me.
So have you been to lots and lots of horse shows since we spoke last, or has the horse show circuit been quiet?
It's in full swing. I was supposed to go to Lubbock last month, but there were just so many storms in the area predicted for driving up and driving back. So I ended up canceling that one just because I don't like hauling horses in severe weather. I mean, I know that's a hot take, but I didn't want to do that.
Well, there's severe weather and there's severe weather. It wasn't just a case of, oh, we're likely to have a thunderstorm today. Your weather report has been end of the world time, folks. So batten down the hatches.
Yes. Yeah. There was some very spinny weather that weekend.
Spinny weather. I like that. Yes. It's spinny weather.
And Lubbock itself is known for its wacky weather. So they had wind blowing a billion miles an hour straight sideways, and then they had snow. So yeah.
No.
Lubbock is one of
that
those places.
That took a second to sink in, you know?
Yeah. They had like a tiny little blizzard. Lubbock is one of those places where, like, in the same weekend, you can have a tornado, fire, and snow. So, and a dust storm. They get those dust storms quite often. So it didn't sound like the most fun. So I'm like, sit this one out. But then I had a show in Hamilton.
And which part of Texas is Hamilton in?
It's kind of like western central Texas. It's okay. I love that area. It's very Texas looking. It's very rocky and there's lots of prickly pear cactus and a little hilly here and there. And there's not a lot of civilization. It's very, very country, horse country, cow country. It's quintessential Texas.
Aha. Uh-huh. And this was another one of the Stock Horse of Texas shows, the circuit you do?
Yes, yes. This is my last year to like try and show. I'm always going to show in the stock horse, but I've been trying to get Remy up in the ranks as far as points. And this is my last year to like go hardcore a show every month. And he's doing pretty good. He got third in a couple of his classes last week. And I can't remember what else he got, but he ended up being fourth overall, which is really good. And again, he's my little Wyoming Mustang, and he's showing against registered cowbred quarter horses. So he holds his own.
So in the classes, because when you compete in a particular, I'm going to call it a division, because you have lots of time, you're in front of the judges in several different classes, and those scores are combined into one big score. Is that how it works?
Yes. So this event's pretty cool because you can go and just show in individual classes that you qualify for. So if you're like, I don't really want to work cattle, you can go and just show in the flat classes, the trail, the pleasure class. But if you want to go for the all-around points, you show in all four divisions, which is ranch trail, ranch pleasure, working cow horse, and reining. And then they add up all your points and they give awards for the all around. And then at the end of the year, they will add up the points for each division. And so you can have year end standing. So last year, I want to say we were fourth or fifth, and we got a bridle. a trophy bridle and a jacket and some nifty patches.
Woohoo! I love it when they give out stuff that you can actually use.
Yes, I am a big doodads person because I like stuff like that. I still love ribbons. And, you know, it doesn't matter that I spent many thousands for a couple of ribbons and a jacket. It doesn't matter. It's the experience and the trophy and the fact that there's like, you know, a record of it. I love it.
Oh, that's great. Well, this is the part of the show, everybody, where Mary educates us with one of her training tips. And if you're new to the Mary Kitzmiller Monthly Show, which happens on the first Thursday of every month, Mary and I get together once a month and we chit-chat about all things horse training. And the topics we chit-chat about, for the most part, are prompted by everybody who listens to the show. They submit questions to Mary and she answers them. And I occasionally toss in some sarcasm. And if you would like to submit questions to the Mary Show, you need to be an auditor. And if you want to become an auditor, you need to go to Patreon and look up Horses in the Morning and be a auditor. Or you can go to Horse Radio Network and you'll find the link there as well. And then you get to be in the super amazing Horse Radio Network Auditors Facebook page, which is where we submit the questions. So what is your training tip this month and what inspired it?
So this one was actually inspired by my own revelations prepping Remy for the shows that I was just talking about, but it's a good tip for everyone. And that is the topic of loose rein riding, which can be scary if you're not used to it.
Well, yeah, especially if you're an English rider. So let's define loose rein riding first, because as a non-Western person, despite the fact that I ride in a Western saddle nowadays, my educational background is not there. So it's pretty shallow. So define loose rein riding from the point of view, particularly for someone who rides in Western tack.
Pretty much it means riding without contact. And in the Western world, the mark of a highly trained horse is a horse that can be ridden one-handed, usually with a drape in the rein. So that horse is operating mostly off of signals. And so we have our own kind of forms of balance and self-carriage and what that looks like in the Western world. And some neat kind of analogies that give you an idea of how high precision the horse needs to be. In the vaquero style or the California style of Western horsemanship, which takes many years and I believe is influenced by European classical riding, among many other things, but that it takes several years to make what's called a bridle horse. And the finished product is a horse that's straight up in the bridle. So this is a horse that's carrying a spade bit and ridden with Rommel reins, which are rawhide reins, which with little woven buttons that give the reins some weight to them so that when they're not engaged, you've got this nice loose drape in the rein. So, you know, this is something that you could spend a lifetime learning how to develop a horse for this and still not have it all figured out. And again, a bridle horse takes years and years to develop. And you start with a snaffle or a hackamore and then work your way to a two rein, which is kind of similar to a double bridle. You have a Bozalita, which is a little rawhide hackamore that sits under your bridle, and you're using the reins that hook to that nose band as well as the reins that hook to the curb bit to help slowly acclimate the horse into riding with a leverage bit. But the test of have I done my job right? The story goes you should be able to take a couple strands of horse hair and tie your Rommel reins to the bit and ride your horse around. And the horse hair should not break. And it's a really incredible visual because if you think about how light your hands need to be to keep some strands of horse hair from breaking when you're working your horse at a high level, I mean, that's like barely touching the reins.
It's very interesting. So, a bazillion years ago, someone equated riding in a double bridle this was someone who grew up in horsemanship in the 40s, that the reins should, you should have no more pressure on the reins than if the reins were made of yarn.
Exactly.
So that's very interesting that a completely, a style of horsemanship that was completely separate. They have no common background, vaquero versus traditional English dressage riding.
Do you know? Think that they have common backgrounds? But that's
a whole other podcast.
We should do a podcast. We've had Jeff Sanders on before, who is, he's an expert in this style of horsemanship and in spade bit. We've had him on before and he was really great. I'd love to see if he'd come back on again and just talk about the history of it, because the history is fascinating. I could talk about it for 8 hours because it was one of my big hyper focuses. And a lot of people in the association I ride with ride with that vaquero style. It's a little bit more fast paced and not as nuanced because it's in the performance show horse world. But in our classes, it is acceptable to ride in hackamore or snaffle or a double bridle or the two rein, which is our version of the double bridle, or with a leverage bit or a spade bit. So very much carrying those traditions. But as far as the styles and the influences, there's a lot of influence from Spanish riding. There's a lot of influence from surrounding areas and countries like Mexico. There is, I think people have theorized that the roots go back to like the Moors in Europe and Africa and all of that kind of stuff. But cool. I definitely think there are some threads in common with dressage, especially classical dressage and the California style. And if you look, like if you look at an older picture of classical riders and what those horses look like, and yes, the curb rein was very loose in a lot of those pictures. And that horse is just really holding himself. You get the idea that you could just let go of the reins and that horse would maintain that frame. And then if you then also search up some like vaquero style horses or California style, like, you know, if you look up bridle horses, you'll see they have very similar frames, very similar tension on the reins. It looks like with just two different sets of tack.
Wow, how interesting. Sorry, I sidetracked you.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, this was a big hyper focus of mine, so I could talk about it for days until people are bored to tears.
So back to the topic again of the loose rein riding.
Yeah. Squirrel,
yes. Yes. So for loose rein riding, so regardless of what discipline one rides in, regardless of what one has on the horse's head, and this is something I see a lot, is people who ride with something that has no bit, not so much with a bozzle or bozal, however you pronounce it, but the various and sundry newer styles of bitless headgear, something they're very much akin to side pulls that we have been around forever, or galloping hackamores that have been around forever. I see a lot of riders who use those who ride with contact that is inappropriate, in that the horse and the rider are balancing off of each other using that device rather than learning to carry themselves so that the tension can be released. So have you found, because you get to see lots and lots and lots of riders, both at competitions as well as your clinics and teaching, that the headgear that we put our horses, that we consider, I'm going to use my air quotes, gentle, have a tendency to emotionally encourage us to become too dependent on that contact and then forget to ride on loose reins?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think regardless of discipline or, you know, whatever you're trying to do with the horse, every horse should be able to walk, trot, and canter on a loose rein without building speed. So if I throw the reins away at the canter, my horse should just keep cantering. He shouldn't take off. If that happens, then I know, man, I've got some real holes in my training. And the thing about the bitless bridles, your hackamores, or your traditional Western hackamore, like the Bazal that I use, is it is a real gauge for how well you've done your prep work with your horse. Because, you know, a horse can run through anything that you put in their mouth. If they are determined enough, a bit's not going to do, it's not going to hold them back. But bits tend to cover up our mistakes of being too dependent on the reins, using the reins as handlebars, using the reins to try to micromanage and control, to try to prevent bad things from happening. A bit doesn't, it, like I said, it covers up those mistakes a little bit better than bitless bridle or hackamore, because you can ride in a hackamore for a little bit and the horse at some point, if you're just pulling and pulling and pulling and trying to control him by holding him in place, at some point the horse is going to be like, you know what? I can just keep going. This isn't not really doing anything to stop me. And it's very easy for them to do that in a piece of equipment like that. And I had to learn, it's a whole other hyper-focus of mine is learning how to ride with a traditional hackamore, which is well worth the experience. But when I first started using it, I thought, oh, I have light hands. I'm a really good trainer. You know, I don't hang on to my horse. But sure enough, I would ride a horse in it for few weeks, and then all of a sudden they're getting bracy. They're getting, you know, I feel like I have to check them a lot more, maybe pull a little bit harder, hold them a little bit harder, till pretty soon the horse is like, you know what? You don't have control, which honestly is kind of an illusion anyway with horses. I had an ex-boss. One of the things he said at clinics when he would make people ride with reins down to the buckle, and of course people would be very nervous about that, he'd say, if you feel like you don't have control, don't worry, you never did anyway. And that's true. Like, of course we can train our horses and control our horses, but we have this illusion in our brains that if I just hold on tight enough to these reins, nothing bad will happen. And it's like, no, you're actually inviting way more bad things to happen.
Yeah. Having control of a horse is not the same as having control of an automobile.
Yeah, you can't just like white knuckle it and the horse will go, oh yeah. Yeah. Because again, you know, I'm a 100-something pound person and the horse is 1,000 pounds. Who is going to win that tug of war? It's a no-brainer.
It's slightly more akin to a bicycle in that you have complete control of the bicycle, but how your body speaks to that bicycle, your balance, where your feet are on the pedals, how you're holding those handlebars, and literally your core, your balance, directly influences what happens in the bicycle. For example, I am not a confident bicycle rider, never have been. So when I ride a bicycle and the ground ahead of me is a unimproved gravel road, my bicycle does not behave well. It wobbles. It doesn't stay in a straight line because my body is very tense, because my brain is saying, oh my gosh, we could fall if we hit that rock. That's the same thing that's happening to your horse. If you're sitting on the horse and you're very tense and you're thinking about the fact that things could go wrong because up ahead there's a barking dog, the horse is absolutely 100% feeling that and reacting to it, just like the bike does. The difference there is the bike is not going to decide, I have had enough of this. You have zero confidence. I'm out of here. It's just going to tip over. So taking the time to learn together, you and your horse, that the reins are not the deal.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And I think the difference is, we often think we can control everything the horse does and that we can prevent the bad things from happening. And that's where riders get into really bad habits of, we kind of go into this like little fetal position when we're riding to protect ourselves. We tense up, we collapse in, our heels come up, we lose our balance. And, you know, that's what our instinct wants to do. And it's the exact opposite of what's actually going to keep us safe in the situation. So we try to, like I said, just prevent all the bad things. So we tense up, we tighten our grip on our horses. We use a little bit more contact. Maybe I'll throw a martingale on them. Maybe I'll go with this bit, that bit, this nose band, you know, and it'll just keep the bad things from happening. And all that really does, it's kind of like if your car has a check engine light and you fix it by punching out the dashboard, it's like, now there's not a problem. So
you put a post-it note over the light. Everybody knows that.
Yeah. So it's fixed. It's not a problem anymore. And that's the same thing as, you know, going up in the severity of your bits or tightening that cavesson down or tightening your grip. You'll get by for a bit and then you won't. And when you won't, it's not going to be good. And so it's the difference between control and your ability to manage, which is very important. So a horse is a living, breathing creature with a mind and feelings and thoughts of his own, and he's a prey animal. This is in his marrow to be a prey animal. I cannot breed or train that out of him, not anytime soon anyway. And so what I can do, instead of trying to prevent my horse from sometimes doing what prey animals do and react, get nervous, want to move their feet, want to build speed, want to tense up, what I can do is give him some tools, or give myself some tools. When that happens, I can manage it. And so you need to take your mind off of this illusion that a tight rein or lots of contact is going to keep you safe, and more into, what can I do to give myself the confidence of, yes, my horse may spook at this sign on the rail, but I have the tools to manage that. It's not going to be a big deal. When you have that in place, then throwing the reins away becomes much easier. And the ironic thing about it, and I learned this lesson many years ago from a really amazing older woman from England. This was in Oklahoma, but she was a dressage and eventer trainer. She's the first person in my years of riding my freight train of a Morgan. I'd been riding for English for, you know, 4 or 5 years at that point. She was the first person to take out the double twisted full cheek, whatever snaffle that I had on her. That was like the bit of the week that was going to fix everything. She took that out. She put a French link snaffle on the horse, and she made me canter around her in a field on a loose rein. And at first I was like, well, I'm just going to die. And as soon as I did it, my horse goes, and she loped like a Western pleasure pony. And I had spent years like white knuckling this horse through eventing courses and in the show pen of her just building speed and building speed and building speed. And my little 11-year-old arms were trying to hold her back. As soon as I got out of her face, she goes, that's what I needed. And she no longer, almost overnight, she was no longer a hot horse. I thought she was a hot, fiery horse. No, overnight she told me, she's like, I wanted to go slow this whole time. But, you know, imagine if someone's just poking and prodding you 24/7 and not giving you any relief, it's going to drive you a little batty. Now, it doesn't happen overnight with every horse the way it did with my Morgan. But how you get there, and the reason that this was inspired was I realized when I've been showing Remy, he does really good in these slow classes. So like the trail class, man, he's a dynamo about that. I could ride him bridleless through those classes. But anytime we add speed, I've noticed he was getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So on his reining circles, he's wanting to go to the outside a little bit, and I'm kind of having to hold him on that circle. He stops really good. He gives me a good sliding stop in a very controlled, relaxed situation where we're practicing it. But in the heat of the show, I'd say whoa and have to really kind of remind him, hey, you need to stop. And the same thing on a cow. We're a disaster on the cow. We're getting better. But when the intensity of the ride is raised, I noticed that he's harder to control. And what I realized I was doing, especially in those faster classes, is I was inadvertently tightening, like taking up slack in my reins and trying to hold him in a position like, if I hold on to you enough, you won't do it. And then I'd quickly learned in the show pen that he's like, no, I will still do it. He's like, I absolutely will do it. And there's nothing you can do to stop me. But so what I finally had to do, it just clicked one day. I'm like, you know what? I am trying to just control every step, and that's just not going to happen. So I spent a few weeks riding him in an open pasture on a loose rein, and I rode him at different speeds and intensities. And I would test out my stop, like no matter how fresh he was or how fast he was going, every so often, I would just say that W word. I'd say, whoa. And I would do it totally expecting him to do it completely right. So I wouldn't try to, like, you know, hold on to him into that stop. I'd be riding on a nice loose rein and I would say that word like he was just going to stop perfect. And if he didn't, then I followed through. Then I picked up on the reins. I said, now you're going to stop and I'm going to maybe do a little turnaround, or I'm going to back you up a couple of steps and then we're going to do it again. But when we do it again, I know that, okay, you didn't stop that one time and I bet you're not going to stop this next time. I still gave him that rein and acted like you're going to do it when I say.
This is interesting. This is really interesting because I'm going through a similar process with baby James. For the uninitiated, baby James is just turned 4, Kentucky Mountain Saddle Horse. So he's gated.
Ooh.
And he was under saddle for 6 months before I got him. And his riding was almost exclusively either in a perfectly flat turf pasture or in a round pen. So terrain of any kind is a little bit new to him. And we've been, from the get-go, we had to learn about loose rein and halt on a loose rein from the rider's balance, because he was ridden into contact from the get-go in a very long shank bit. Now, admittedly, long shank bit, the contact was feather light, but it was there. there's no question that it was there.
There's a lot of torque.
Yeah, you only had to have such, I mean, I had ounces in the reins, but that's where his life was. So we're learning about halt or half halt from weight alone. And I find myself, when he's feeling go-y, because he has a natural motor of his very own, or when we're out and about, that I do the exact same thing. I expect him to not halt or half halt or slow down. So I tend to tense up and gather up too much contact. Now he's on a much, 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 much smaller bit now. The shank on the bit is about an inch now. It's a Kimberwick now. So we've kind of amped it.
Oh, yeah.
But I do the exact same thing. I'm going, well, he's all amped up. He's all nervous. He's spooky. So the contact's still light, but I've really, really shortened the reins and I'm not giving him the opportunity to come back from my weight. I'm just assuming he's not going to, so I'm in his mouth. Oh my gosh, I'm doing the exact same thing.
We all do. And it's actually a big Achilles heel of mine. And yeah, I should say at the end of that couple week riding period, when I took him to this last show, he scored one of his highest reining scores ever. He actually did sliding stops for me. He did incredible. But yeah, you know, gated horses are really interesting because there's a lot of misconceptions about how to get a horse to gate and what you can and can't do with a gated horse. Some of those are like, oh, never let them trot. You know, you don't want them to build that bad habit.
Whole new podcast.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing, you know, and, you know, oh no, they need to be ridden straight. Don't do all the bending and lateral stuff with gated horses. No, you don't do that. And actually, my first words of advice, I found out a mule I had been showing was actually very gated. I had no idea. I just thought he made a weird trotting thing going into the canter. And someone's like, you know, he's really gated, right? I'm like, no. So then I was like, well, okay, now that I know he's gated, how do I make him gate? And I asked someone, they're like, make him real angry. And he pretty much said, put a big bit in their mouth and pull on those reins and kind of bother him and do it. And I'm like, okay, which, yeah, no, don't do that. And some of the best gated trainers that I've seen treat gated horses like a horse first, and then they're gated second. And so they'll do all the same things on a gated horse that you might see at like a Buck Brannaman clinic. They'll work on all those gates. They'll work on lateral. They'll work on just good, solid foundation horsemanship. Get that horse riding on a nice, loose rein. And by the end of it, when you ask them to gate, it's beautiful. So yeah, so gated horses too should be able to be ridden on a loose rein. You should be able to ideally have them in a snaffle and work on lateral, work on all those gates. It's not, if they're naturally gated, it's not going to destroy their ability to gate. Now, a gated expert might disagree with me there, but in general, I just want to go down the trails with my horse, you know, just good, solid horsemanship first. And then you can go into specializing. Okay. What's going to really help bring out that gait? But
I'll end the gated conversation with this.
Yes.
Is we are led to believe that a gated horse, not all gated horses have the same inbred genetic quality of gait. Just like if you take a horse that can walk, trot, canter, walk, jog, lope. Not every horse has a good quality walk. Not every horse has a good quality trot with suspension and throughness. If you watch a Western pleasure bred quarter horse trot, it's never had a human on his back. His trot's going to be very different than the trot that you see from a Hackney or the trot you see from a thoroughbred. There's that same arc in every gated horse. So if you have a horse that has the amazing gait genetically, he's been bred specifically to have amazing gaits, the rider's influence over those gaits can be less. You can plop a potato up there and they're going to gait reasonably well. Just like if you put a potato of a rider on an amazing Dutch warm blood, you're going to get some pretty amazing gaits even with a potato sitting on his back. That's that same arc. I just happen to have a budget for a horse with only medium genetics in his gait. Because I discovered pretty quickly, if you have a horse that you can put a potato on and he will gait all day and gait beautifully all day with a potato on his back, you'd better remortgage your house.
Yes. Same goes for gated mules. People pay money, especially if it's got like a splash of color.
Oh yeah.
People pay good money for those.
Yeah, that's again a whole new podcast. But anyway, fantastic, interesting stuff when it comes to loose rein riding. It applies globally. Everybody needs to do it. And if you haven't done it in a long time, start with the basics. Can I walk on a loose rein? And you know, you practice it a little often versus, oh, I have to spend my entire ride on a loose rein today. Just like everything else in riding, it's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of small bits and bobs. And I've got a sneaking suspicion that a couple of our listener submitted questions are going to relate back to that, because they usually do.
Yes. Everything is everything else.
Everything is everything else. And after our training tip each month is where we stop for a quick chat about our sponsors. And one of our sponsors this month is Chewy, chewy.com. You may have heard of it. It's a fantastic website where they sell all sorts of things, but they also have horse products nowadays. A lot of people might not realize that. And you can keep your horse feeling his best with the supplements and the brands that you trust, because lots of our horses eat supplements, and they can deliver it right on time with Chewy Auto Ship. And you will never run out again with the easy repeat deliveries on your schedule, and you can save big time while you're at it. You can get 40% off your first auto ship order of supplements for your horse, and use the code EQSUP as an equine supplement, EQSUP at checkout, and you can have your favorite supplements delivered right to your door. Go to chewy.com/equine, and they have a very easy to use intuitive interface for your auto ship. Not all auto ship systems are built the same. There's this easy to use. Go to chewy.com/equine and use EQSUP at checkout for 40% off your first auto ship. Ding, 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 ding. So it's time for our first listener question. What is it? Who's it from?
Our first question is from Elizabeth Frey, and she says, I have a 3-year-old filly. I've put a bit in her mouth many times, but she's still very chompy. Do I need to do it more often in very short sessions or keep the bit in her mouth until she relaxes? So, interesting question, and there's a lot I don't know about what's going on with this horse. However, what I'm gleaning from the question is she's 3 years old, so she's very green. It sounds like you've put a bit in her mouth many times, but maybe you don't normally ride her in the bit. Or I don't know if you're still at the ground stage with her, but groundwork stage with her, but it sounds like, you know, she does the thing when you first put a bit in a baby's mouth where they're very chompy because they're like, oh my gosh, what's this thing in my mouth? I don't know what to do. And usually they move past that. Sounds like she's still very much in that phase. So normally there are things you can do to just double check, make sure the bit is not causing discomfort or pain, you know, make sure she's up to date on her dental work, doesn't have any sharp points or hooks, make sure it's a suitable bit for her. But this kind of sounds like this is just a normal thing she's going through as a green horse. One of the other things I will check up on is the bit's position in my horse's mouth. So I'm a little bit of what a lot of people tell you to do. There's been a lot of advice on when you set a bit in a horse's mouth that, oh, I don't want any wrinkles in the horse's mouth. A lot of Western people say this. They're like, I don't want any wrinkles because I don't want that bit pulling on their mouth. I don't always agree with that because what I've noticed is if your bridle is too loose and the bit's hanging a little low, the horses can tend to feel a little discomforted by it and they will kind of gape and chew and I feel like sometimes, not all the time, I feel like sometimes the horse feels more comfortable if I adjust that bridle a little bit more snug. A good sign for me if the bit is sitting right is if I pull the reins, I don't want to see the cheek pieces of the bridle like bow and come off the horse's mouth. If I see that happening when I'm using my reins, to me, that means the bit is too loose. So sometimes I will, and on babies, I tend to set that bit even higher than I normally would, just because it helps discourage them from getting their tongue over the bit. So play around with the adjustment of your bridle. Maybe she likes it a little bit looser. Maybe she likes it a little bit snugger. How I would tackle this issue is I would kind of pretend like she does not know what a bit is. So when I introduce the bit to my horses, I will put the bridle with no reins over the halter and just let them wear it. And I do all my work, all my riding, all my groundwork based using that halter. And the bit is just there. I want to give my horse plenty of time just to feel the bit before I ever pick up on those reins, because that can be really tricky if the horse is like, ugh, this thing in my mouth, I don't like it. And then you're also trying to control them with it. So that's where I'd start with this mare, is I would spend time just letting her wear it, put it on for your groundwork sessions, put it on for your riding, but use a halter or something else to actually guide and steer your horse and just let them wear the bit. I also will put a bridle with no reins. And I actually have a bridle that has no brow band and a simple snaffle bit that I put on the horse for when they're standing tied. So they can just, you know, as I'm tacking them up or after I've worked them a little bit, I'll let them stand tied and just wear the bit. You want to be careful though. Don't do it place where they could get that bridle hung up on anything, you know, so just kind of use common sense where that's concerned. But yeah, I would just start with this horse of just letting her wear and experience the bit and don't pick up on it for a while, you know, see if that doesn't settle her down. Again, there's some other things you can do. Like I said, adjusting the bridle, you might want to try different types of bits, different mouthpiece shapes to see if there's something that she would prefer. But my gut is telling me that she just needs to spend time wearing a bit and just getting used to it.
Yeah, some horses are particular about the shape of the mouthpiece or even the thickness of the mouthpiece. So that I like that idea. If she's at that phase, and it sounds like she's at that phase where the horse is just getting used to the fact that there's a bit in her mouth. The height, how many wrinkles, or the shape or thickness might not be suitable. So maybe visit some of your friends who have a big bit collection, or if you have a big bit collection, find something to sort of wore it for 20 minutes today, 3 days in a row, no change. Okay, completely different mouthpiece. Go from single jointed to double jointed. 3 days in a row for 30 minutes each time. Oh, look, she got a big difference, because that does make a difference. I know that baby James would really prefer me to have something in his mouth that has less of a nutcracker that seems to make him more fussy. The trick is finding one that I can afford to buy and not have to remortgage the house. But versus, and Nigel was the same way. He preferred less nutcracker shape, whereas Scooter seems to appreciate that nutcracker shape, a single joint. That's what he likes. Don't want double jointed. Don't want single bar. Want double joint, single joint. So that might be an interesting way to help her out. She might just be fussing because she doesn't like the way it lies in her mouth. And some horses are real sensitive to it, and some are like, eh, whatever.
Yeah. And two more things I'll bring up is, this ties back into the loose rein riding. Sometimes they're getting real chompy and fussy with the bit because they're not finding relief from the rider. So really work on your timing. So yeah. So with babies, when I ride young horses around, I may pick up on that horse and ask them to do something with that bridle 1,000 times in the ride, but I pick up, ask, get the response, release. I do a lot of releasing on that rein in the beginning because they're learning. They're learning how to do all this stuff. So if I ask my horse to do something and then I maintain a constant pull, they're going to be like, why did I do that? Because nothing changed for me after I obeyed you. So now I'm going to get frustrated. I'm just going to start chomping. So that is something to pay attention to. Ask for what you want. Once you get it, release. Give them that relief. And that can help eliminate chompiness. Sometimes it's not the bit. It's just a sign of something else going on in their mental state. So it could be a sign of anxiety. It could be a sign of boredom. So you just might want to check out that areas of your horse's life. If they're really tense, they're more likely to chomp at the bit. So sometimes the issue is not change the bit, change the position. It's, okay, let's get you in a better state of mind. And then that symptom, that chomping can subside. So it could be a million things, like most horse training is. But those are where I'd start.
There we go. Good stuff. And speaking of good stuff, Sentinel Horse Feeds, they have good stuff. Sentinel Horse Feed knows you share an unbreakable bond with your horse and that you'd do anything to keep them happy and healthy. Just like you're dedicated to your horse's well-being, Sentinel's expert nutritionists are dedicated to creating feed that supports their health. Sentinel's full line of 100% extruded feed formulas are designed for easier digestion compared to pellets. Extruded nuggets break down as soon as your horse takes a bite, releasing essential nutrients exactly where they're meant to be absorbed. Discover how extruded feed helps your horse live a healthier life. Visit feedsentinel.com/yourhorse. That's feedsentinel.com/yourhorse to learn more or find a retailer near you. And who's our next questionnaire?
Okay, we have a question from Ariel. She says, my 5-year-old thoroughbred gelding sat for a year and a half after failing race training before being restarted. He loses his mind when any noise comes from the barn aisle that he can't see. So my question is, what can I do to keep him from bolting and literally losing his mind? Because it takes me up to 5 minutes to bring him back to a semi-relaxed state to continue working. Yeah, that can be frustrating. And I've had horses that have experienced that, especially if the arena you're riding in, if it kind of connects to the barn aisle in such a way that they can't see up and down the aisles, but they can hear stuff going on. That can really wig them out. So I assume this is happening when you're riding, that he's bolting, and even if it's not, even if this is on the ground, my suggestion would be go back to groundwork. You do not want bolting to become an issue. If it's taking you more than a few seconds to get your horse back to earth from a bolt, then we really need to find the holes and really tackle that, because the more he's able to run off without being shut down, that's just going to be his go-to without even thinking, yeah. Because it's yeah. worked for him.
He's rehearsing the behavior in the fancy parlance of learning scientists. Yes, he's rehearsing the behavior, and the more times they rehearse it, the more ingrained it gets to be. Absolutely. Yeah. This is going to be tough. Okay. I'm tuned in.
Yeah. Don't give him a chance to practice the bad stuff. So I would go all the way back down to groundwork with this horse. And again, this ties into the whole loose rein thing. You cannot physically make this horse not spook and totally be fine. You can't physically hold him in a way that's going to like keep him from wanting to bolt or move his feet. But what you can do is have a really good system in place to manage his reactions, that it's quick, it's effective. I can redirect him immediately and, you know, stop the behavior before it even is a thing. Now, it takes a while before the horse just naturally has a calmer mindset. Oftentimes with horses like this, horses that want to bolt or just are extremely reactive on the ground and under saddle, what it looks like me managing it is I have a one rein stop when I ride. That's my emergency brake. And I have a very similar process on the ground. I do a lot of hind quarter yields and I practice hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those. Because oftentimes what happens with this horse, let's say I'm riding him and I'm riding him around the arena and something spooks him and he just head up goes into the bolt. I would immediately slide one hand down the reins and bring his head around and do a one rein stop, which means a hind quarter yield, and just it stops it right in its tracks. And what usually happens with this horse is not, oh, I'm cured, I'm no longer afraid, you know, we can continue. They're usually still in a pretty heightened state. If I safely think I can ride it out, what I do is, so the horse begins to spook again, and I don't do this like 10 minutes into the bolt, because now you're on a runaway horse. I, you know, if that horse even smells like it's going to happen, shut him down. So I do my one rein stop until my horse stops moving their feet, and I will hold them in a lateral flex until they stop moving their feet and they soften into that bit. As soon as they do that, I release that rein completely. And I'm like, that's where I need you. Now, knowing this horse, he's probably going to spook he's probably going to want to do something in the next millisecond. He's probably going to go, hey, I'm going to bolt again. So then what I do is I usually slide my hand down the other rein. I go, no. And I shut him down immediately. I do it firm, controlled, not hastily, not aggressively, but I will take my hand down that rein as far as I need to and take a hold of that horse's mouth, bring them around, shut them down. I'll wait till their feet have stopped moving and I wait for them to relax that neck and soften to that bit a little bit. And then as soon as they do that, I let go of the rein again. Now, I don't let go of my reins completely. I still have one hand on the rein, but I let go of the rein again. And I tell that horse, that's where I need you. Now, this time he may spook again. Maybe he waits 5 seconds and he goes, you know what? I can't stand still. I have to spook again. I do that. I might have to do that 100 times in the ride. And so I do a lot of one rein stops at the walk, trot, and canter with horses like this. And again, a lot of times I get a really hot and fractious horse that, let's say I'm trying to walk on a loose rein. I just want to walk you around the arena. I don't even care where we go. I just want you to walk relaxed on a loose rein. I'm going to treat him as if he is going to be perfect. So I'm not going to go in that arena with a death grip on the reins, because then he, in his mind, he's going to go, oh crap, you're nervous too? Okay, something's happening. I also have to be nervous, because they're herd animals. And they're looking at their herd mate and goes, well, she's really freaked out too. So there's definitely a reason to be scared. This is where I have to act very differently on the outside than how I feel on the inside. So I'm the person who's like, let's go for a trail ride on a loose rein in the arena. Let's just go for a walk. I am very prepared to manage them quickly if anything happens, but I'm going to always give them the chance to do it right. So I have a nice deep seat. If I'm riding in a Western saddle, I'll usually have one hand at the end of my reins, and then I put that hand on the saddle horn. So if they do jump forward, you know, I can stay seated more easily. And then my free hand will be the one that slides down the rein and redirects. So let's say I'm riding that horse, just want to ride him on a loose rein at a walk. So they walk two steps and then freak out because something happens. Something made a noise. So as soon as they go into that bolt, they start building speed and intensity. Slide my hand down, one rein stop. Again, wait for them to stop their feet, soften. As soon as I feel like, okay, are we back under control? Then I say, okay, let's try that again. I know that you can walk on a loose rein. And I'll do it again, pretending like they're just going to do it perfect. I stay nice and relaxed, act like I'm on an old broke cow pony, and we're checking the fences. If they maintain a good walk, I leave them alone. I'm like, I won't get in your way. If you want to have this state of mind, I won't get in your way. And then maybe they go two or three steps this time, and then they spook, shut them down again. Then I'll let them try it again. Maybe this time they go five or six or seven steps. As long as they're not building speed and they're using their brain, I'll leave you alone. And I may spend weeks on this horse where the only thing I do with him every day is 400,000 one rein stops in the pen. What this is going to do is it's going to let me and my horse practice these one rein stops over and over and over and over again until it's muscle memory for both of us, so that when a real emergency happens, let's say a runaway horse comes busting by, or, you know, or something just really crazy happens, my horse is not going to think bolts. They're going to think, oh, I better listen to my person because she's probably going to ask me to do something right now. Takes a lot of time to start getting that neuropathway built. And I'll practice it for months if I have to, because I'm not moving on until I know that I can shut you down easily and that I can get you in a good state of mind. So everything else gets put on hold until we fix this. So I do that at all three gates until it's muscle memory for me. It's muscle memory for them. That way I can react quickly in an emergency rather than panicking for a few seconds and then go, oh yeah, I need to do something here. So that gives you your emergency break. It makes your emergency break really good. It's going to give you more confidence, because when you are successful at this time and time again, then you have that tool in your head, in your brain. You're like, I know that if anything happens, I have a really good break on this horse. So that's one thing. What one rein stops tend to do, because it is kind of a lateral maneuver. Usually it's involving swinging their hip. A lot of times a one rein stop for me is I end up 180 degrees completely face the other way. Something about that maneuver kind of resets the horse's brain in a way that just trying to pull them back or half halt them back doesn't do. So what it kind of looks like in the horse's mind is the horse is walking along and he's like, I'm getting pretty nervous. Oh my gosh, something's happening. I have to bolt. You shut them down by, you know, getting that 180 degree turn, and the horse is like, huh, what? Wait, what was I spooking at something? I can't remember. Oh yes, I was spooking at something. So it gives them it creates that like 5-second pause just to reset their brain. Again, they might go right back to it. And in that case, I shut them down again and again and again and again. And I will practice this. The more you practice this, if you do this correctly and you're relaxed about it, you're not using the one rein stop as punishment. You don't want to be aggressive about it. I'll be as firm as I have to, but my hands are going to move very fluidly. My seat's going to stay really deep. I'm going to breathe. Maybe I'll talk to my horse in soothing tones. This is about trying to get them back down to earth, not trying to punish them for bad behavior. So what tends to happen over time is my horse can start walking longer and longer distances without freaking out, and then trotting longer and longer distances without freaking out. And then the same with the canter. It tends to help calm down their mind and get them to reset. After a while, your horse, because you were able to successfully interrupt that thought process for that horse hundreds of times, after a while, the horse is going to start doing some risk assessment and thinking, yeah, I don't really like that sound in the barn aisle, but it's not worth losing my head over. It's not worth all that effort. I'm going to conserve my energy and, you know, listen to my person. So that's where I would start. If you don't feel like you'll be successful under saddle, I'd also find a really, really good groundwork program or a trainer who has a really, really good groundwork program. So
I know one. Her name's Mary Kitzmiller.
Oh yeah, that's neat.
It's a really good program. Yeah.
Yes. So there's lots of them out there, but get them, you know, you wanna be able to manage the reaction, and you manage it until their instinct to react in such a way it fades away over time. And the, you know, part of the reason it fades away over time is I stepped right in and stopped it before it had a chance to be anything. If I let that horse bolt with me several feet two or three times, now I'm starting to get a real habit ingrained, and now it's going to be very difficult. So I always treat them like they're going to act perfect, nice loose rein, stay relaxed, but I am quick to shut it down if it's anything but perfect.
Would it be useful to use what you call your fire drill system, where you have a horse, you can't control when sounds that cause this horse to go over threshold, you can't control when they happen in the aisleway. But if you set up training scenarios where you have a helper create a sound, a pre-rehearsed sound that you think is going to send a horse at least slightly over threshold while you're in the arena, so you can rehearse these behaviors. Okay, I'm going to go in the arena. I'm going to have my horse in a groundwork situation. When I count to 10, and you can hear me count, and when I get to 10, you're going to make that noise that I'm pretty sure is going to at least slightly send my horse over threshold, so that I can rehearse this scenario. Okay, 1, 2, 3, I get to 10. You are going to drop a bucket on the ground, so it makes a really big loud noise. I can rehearse. My horse goes, oh my God, I'm going to die. Bring him back down using my groundwork techniques. Everything is cool. We're going to walk around. When I count to 10 and you hear me say 10 again, we're going to do that again. But you can do that when you're ready to take it on. And you can do that 10 times during a session so that you can rehearse these things, so that when they happen in an unrehearsed fashion, you have some experience under your belt. I think that might be an interesting way to go.
Yeah, that's definitely something you can look into. On this particular horse, I wouldn't set that up for, like you said, for a little bit. I would do some more basic stuff first, because this horse sounds like he's already going to find something to spook at. So you don't really need to, at this point, set up scenarios like that. What I will do, like this one rein stop, I practice these even if my horse isn't freaking out. I'll still do this hundreds of times on my calmest horse, because you never know. I don't want to find out that I can't manage a horse's reaction when I'm like in the middle of a mountain trail ride and found out, oh, he spooks at rain slickers. I don't want to know that I can't control him in that situation. I set this all up in a safe arena, and I practice and practice and practice of, you know, going to let you go, shut you down, let you go, shut you down. On the ground, same thing. Now, desensitizing skills would also be really excellent for this horse, but I'm not going to practice with the scariest thing or the thing that they're spooking at right now. So let's say they don't like the sound of feed buckets. That really sets him off. When I introduce desensitizing to this horse, I'm not going to start with feed buckets. I'm going to start with something that should probably barely get a rise out of them. So I start with, hey, can I just touch you all over with my hands? Are you cool with that? You'd be so surprised at how many people are riding horses that don't even like being touched. And I'm like, girl, you're on a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, I've had that. You're sitting on a horse that you're unfamiliar with, and you simply reach behind the saddle and pat him on the bum. Just a little gentle. Oh, what a good. And all of a sudden you're on the ground.
Yeah. So I start with you know, very easy, very basic, so that I can, so I don't send my horse into panic mode. I don't want them over threshold to where they're just thinking about surviving. I want that horse to go, oh, I don't know if I like being touched there. Maybe I'll move a little bit. Oh, you're going to teach me what I need to do. Okay, great. I want it to be a thoughtful process. So I'll start with my hands. Then I'll say, okay, can I throw that? I use a nice long, soft lead rope. Can I throw the lead rope all around you? And it's a pretty quiet thing, but some horses can really freak out at that. So I'll do the lead rope and I'll teach my horse all the rules of what to do if something makes you uncomfortable. So again, I cannot force this horse to stand still and take it. I, you know, even if I tried tying all his feet together, he would find a way to flip out. So I teach my horse on the ground, I'm going to stand at your shoulder. I'm not going to pull on your face unless you are moving away and I need to manage what you're doing. I'm going to start moving this lead rope all around you. I'm going to throw it over your back because that's a less sensitive area instead of like throwing it around your back legs to start. So I'm going to throw it at your back. If the horse wants to move, again, I cannot force him to stand still, but I can control how he moves. So I tip his nose toward me and say, okay, you need to move. That's okay. I'm going to keep throwing this rope while you're moving, but I'm going to keep you in a hind quarter yield. So I don't want your front feet going anywhere too far. I want your hind quarters to yield around. And that's hard work for a horse. So after a while, he's going to go, is this lead rope really all that scary? Nah, I think I'm just going to stand still and relax a little bit. And that's when I stop throwing the lead rope. So I start there with very easy things. And I just get this really good, like, oh gosh, what my brain just, I just make a lot of these deposits in my bank account over and over and over of the horse moves his feet. I show him what to do. He gets rewarded when he does the right thing. And if I can practice that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, it's going to start coming quicker and quicker to him where he'll come back down to earth much quicker. It's not going to take you 5 minutes to try and talk him back down. And then eventually he's just not even going to react. And it can take years. It's just it's a slow, thoughtful process I do over time. Once you have him desensitized to basic things, you know, I'll desensitize him to the lunge whip, to the lariat. I love flag work. So just kind of the basic tools I use around, maybe I'll start jumping up and down when I'm with the horse, maybe clapping my hands. And once that happens, now I can start getting into what if I have a stick with a plastic bag tied to the end of it? Or what if I get a folded up tarp and start moving that tarp around you? And then you can start getting into crazier things. Like I've taken this all the way up to the level of fireworks in the arena. I've, you know, done smoke bombs. I've done all of that. But all of that stuff, by the time I get to the fireworks and smoke bombs, I've actually never had a horse spook at any of those things because I had such a strong history. Yeah.
When it's done well, the first five things you do cause reactions. By the time you've gotten the 50th thing, it's like, what can I find to make him go crazy? Yeah, it should get better and easier and better and easier. If it's going the reverse, as you amp things up, if the horse reacts more, your process is flawed. You need to go back down to the, what if I snap my fingers near you?
Interesting. And if he looks at you like that wasn't scary, then I say, okay, well, that doesn't seem to scare you. So I'll move on to something else. I'd much rather do that than find out, oh, you didn't like this and you're going to kill me and everyone in this arena. And But once I get to the really scary things, what I've done with my horse is it's almost like a game. I'm like, here's the game we're playing. Here, I'm laying out all the rules for you. I'm going to be very clear with what I want to happen. I'm going to be very clear with my boundaries. You can move, but you can't walk on top of me. Things like that. You can move, but you can't move forward because that's where we can lose control of the horse because now they can go into a bolt. You know, this is what I'm going to allow. This is what I'm not going to allow. I'm going to put very clear and careful protocols, and I'm going to show my horse how to find the answer. That's the most important thing. The horse needs to start searching for the answer themselves instead of shutting down. And that's doing all these games with your horse does that. And so after a while, and I find that I use a lot of positive reinforcement with these exercises as well, so that now if I were to come running into the arena to Remy with like the scariest thing I could imagine, he would probably like startle a little bit, but I can see his mind working. He would be like, nope, it's a game. There's rules to this. I have to figure my way out. And he would be so much quicker to solve the problem rather than just to turn his brain off and panic. So consistency is key.
There we go. Tons of cool stuff.
Easy, effective, and eco-friendly fly control starts with Fly Predators. Fly predators are the organic, natural way to dramatically minimize your fly problem. Learn more about fly predators and other Spalding Labs fly control solutions at spalding-labs.com.
And we've got time for one more question. This one looks like it's from Nicole.
Yes, Nicole, and her question is how to get a horse ready or used to camping with either hobbles, a high line, or staying tied at a trailer for a long time, or staying at the trailer for a long time. I'd love to have a solution to let my horse graze in an area without running away or getting tangled in a long line without having to be constantly supervised in situations where you can't bring fencing. Great question. And it, like the previous questions, it involves developing a skill set over time. So again, and I know that Nicole knows this, but I am not going to get my horse broke to camping by driving to the nearest mountain and hoping for the best and being like, I'm sure you'll stay here. I'm going to start practicing the skills we need at home in a very safe environment that's low intensity. So, you know, my nice, big, safe, cushy arena where my horse is already relaxed. This is where I'm going to start introducing those skills. So hobbling is excellent for any horse to learn. I have had situations where I've had horses get caught in fences and did not take a hide off of them, because they knew to just stand and wait and not pull against pressure. And I fully believe it's because of all the things that I've done with lariats and ropes and hobbles to teach my horse how to accept pressure. Now, hobbling can be done very wrong, and people often just think of the practice on the whole as abusive because of how restrictive it is. But it's not different than tying, because if you think about it, like I'm tying my horse to a solid object by his head. Yeah, that sounds horrible if you don't know how to train it properly. Hobbling is the same way. So there's a lot of great articles and programs on hobbling, but I will start in the arena. Usually I like to work on it at the end of my groundwork session or at the end of my ride. So my horse is kind of already like, I want to stand still and relax a little bit. So before I ever put hobbles on them, I get them used to ropes all around their legs. I should be able to throw that rope all around all four legs without them freaking out. I should be able to use my lead rope or a lariat to pick up all four legs and they just give it to me. This is also a great exercise if your horse won't stand for the farrier. So I should be able to put a rope around that horse's foot and pick it up. And they just say, here you go. Here's my foot. When they get that going really good, I will teach them to lead by their front feet. So I will have it to where I can pick up that horse's foot with the rope and pull it forward and set it down and, you know, get good enough to where that horse will follow you all around by his foot. With the back feet, I will just teach my horse how to lift that back foot with the rope, stretch it out behind. And I work on it just diligently over time until it's so not a big deal. He feels pressure. He just gives me his foot. That's a good skill, even if you're not going to go camping. Once I get that the horse to that level of, I'm so unbothered by this, then I can start working on hobbles. And again, there's a lot of great books and articles that go really in depth on how to do this. So I definitely invest in one of those, because I can only say so much in podcast form. But when I want to start hobbling my horse, the hobbles that I tend to use are like the leather ones or rope ones that go around both of the front feet. So maybe the end of my ride, I I hop off my horse. I'll tie the reins up over the saddle horn, or I can even take the bridle off or put a halter on him. And I'll put a set of hobbles around his front feet, and I'll just stand there with him. So I actually do recommend probably having something on his head, and I'll stand there with him. And again, if I have done all of my homework with the groundwork, he might test those hobbles a little bit, but he might kind of go, oh, I can't quite pick up my feet, and put his feet back down. He should not completely flip out and panic. If that's happened, that means I've skipped something. So I'll let him just kind of feel those hobbles and test them out for about 5 minutes, take them off, put them away. And then that's just going to be a habit after every single groundwork or riding session, is just in the middle of the arena. I don't tie them up when I do this. Throw on the set of hobbles, and maybe I like to go sit on my mounting block and play on my phone for a few minutes. So it's all very supervised. I don't want to teach this horse to move around with the hobbles. So I want to really manage that, because a horse can gallop with hobbles. I've seen it. It is not fun. So I don't want to just leave my horse and let him figure out how to move everywhere with the hobbles. I just do short sessions that he can mentally handle, take the hobbles off and do that. Just make it a habit every day, until he can stand longer and longer and longer and longer. And then I can start just kind of using the hobbles in my daily riding, you know, riding out. And maybe I'm going to go check the mail instead of riding you out there. And I can get off, throw on the hobbles, go check the mail, come back. So just building on all these skills over time. Now, you will have some horses that do learn to move around quite a bit with the hobbles, or maybe you're in a situation where you're like, ah, man, I really can't afford if this horse ran with the hobbles. We're out in the open. What you can do in that situation is take a rope and go from one of the horse's back feet and tie it to the center of the hobble. So he could still move a little bit, but it's really going to be difficult for him to run off. So that is my very abbreviated thing with hobbles. But the root of that issue is practice early, practice often, be consistent, build duration over time. So by the time you go to the big camping trip, it's not a big deal. Yeah. Same goes for just tying in general. So many people don't tie their horses nearly enough. And I'm not talking about tying them up to a tree and then coming back tomorrow and letting whatever happens, happens. I know some people go that route with training, and I'd say that's a recipe for lots of bad things happening. Just like the hobbles, I start tying them. I have tie spots in my arena. I do it after the ride, and I tie you up for 5 minutes, and then 10 minutes, and then 30 minutes. And then maybe I'll tie you up in your stall for an hour with a saddle. Like, you're saddled up, ready to go. I'll tie you in your stall while I ride another horse, and you stand there for an hour. Or maybe after your bath, I'm going to go back and tie you in stall, or tie you in the arena, or tie you to the fence. And you can stand there for an hour or two. You can nibble on a hay bag, whatever. Maybe I'll take you to my horse trailer and tack you up there and tie you there. And then I'm going to start just doing it to where I can trust you for several hours. And I build to that over time. I've never had an issue with a horse I trained to tie where I've had any like problems with the horse pawing or freaking out, because I've just built on these skills over time. So whether you're hobbling or anything like that, teaching them to tie is also a good thing. Just helps build patience. The high line bit, I would say you're going to use most of those same skills. I will, disclaimer, I have never used a high line myself. So I'm going to bow out of giving a detailed answer on that one, because I'm sure there's some nuance to using high line that I don't know about. But I imagine using a lot of these same skills, have a good setup, practice it a lot, build duration over time. And then the final thing before you maybe go out onto the camping trip is you want to proof these behaviors. So that's where, okay, my horse stands perfectly tied in his stall, or he stands perfectly tied in his arena at home. But what if more is going on? You know, what if we're at a horse show? Is he going to do it then? So I'm going to start tying him in situations and places that have a little bit more going on. Like, I have a fence outside of my arena that's near the road. It's not right on the road, but a lot of people drive by. You know, we've got garbage trucks and stuff, it's still a very safe place. If my horse came untied, they would still be in a pen, but it just lets that horse start experiencing sights and sounds and different things. So I'll start increasing the challenge and intensity of the environment where they're tied. And usually by then, if I practice all these things pretty diligently, like, just like the last question, the horse is well equipped to know how to react if he gets nervous about things, because you've had many successful sessions with this.
Practice. It's just time. And every time I do the show with you, I'm going, geez, I just need to practice this crap more.
Me too. I was just thinking with one of my training horses, I'm like, you know, I have not tied him outside of the arena yet, and I probably ought to do that.
There we go. I was just thinking the same thing. You know, I need to find myself a tree. Just need to tie everybody up. Just do it. The tree of knowledge. There we go. Well, for folks who want to stay tuned, folks, by the way, but there is a post show today. So auditors, stay tuned. Where can they find you online if they want to have you do a clinic, help you with some training issues, purchase some of your training videos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Find me on Facebook at Mary Kitzmiller Horsemanship or online, marykitzmiller.com. And then my brain just, yes, find me at those places.
Find you at those places. Mary needs more Diet Coke. That's the problem.
Oh, Diet Coke is my nectar. I actually am out of Diet Coke and I only slept a couple hours last night. So yeah, I can definitely feel the engine is fading a little bit.
Yeah, a little low and the tank's a little bit low. Glenn and Jamie will be back again tomorrow with more fun and hijinks. So we'll all see you then. Auditors, stick around. There's more.